the fact that there was such an uptick in the purchase and acquisition of weaponry tells me definitively that she had to know something was up. Honestly, how many long guns would have to be drug into your house before you realized something had changed? It's what's known as a pre-incident indicator, and there are actually several of them that have been unfolding over the last 72 hours.
An army of federal and local LA County Sheriff deputies from the Lakewood Station stormed house after house in Hawaiian Gardens early this morning. They were out arresting members of a Latino gang mainly operating in the Hawaiian Gardens area. Agents also seized scores of handguns, assault rifles, and other weapons. They say they have indicted nearly 150 members of the gang and associates for numerous violent crimes, including shootings and more. Investigators say there are federal racketeering indictments detailing guns and drugs. They say the gang is notorious for targeting blacks.
As you spell out in the indictment, we learned during the investigation of this case that this particular street gang has a hatred towards African Americans, and they would target on occasion African Americans, not African American gang members, not African American anything other than the fact that they're African Americans.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. My name is Lisa Zambetti and I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is
Maureen O'Connell, retired FBI agent from the Los Angeles field office. I've worked there for 25 years.
So what's going on today? Where are Jim and Laura, you're asking? Well, I'm sorry to tell you, they're not here today. You're stuck with me. You know, last year, our longtime listeners are going to remember that Jim and Laura had to go on a super secret assignment out of town that we couldn't talk about, where they were reinvestigating an old case. And a lot of you know what I'm talking about. Well, guess what? They're at it again. That's right. They're reinvestigating another very famous case that many of you are very interested in. And it's taking every ounce of self-control not to tell you what that case is. Look, my hands are like...
And unlike Lisa, I have no problem keeping secrets. I actually enjoy withholding information from people.
That's what I like about you. So anyway, so they're not here today. The kid is driving the car. Hopefully we won't crash. And Maureen O'Connell has agreed to be here today. So I met Maureen at CrimeCon. When was that? That was
last year
in Indianapolis. She was part of the XG team that we all descended upon Indianapolis. And I didn't get to know her that well, but I know about her. And I thought, you know, who could I drag in here to talk to me about some things that I know you guys are going to find fascinating? There's a million things I want to ask her. But first of all, can you just tell people how you got into the FBI, what your journey was there? Because a lot of our listeners want to join the FBI. They want to get into this kind of work, whether it's what you did or behavioral science and stuff like that. So can you just give them a little bullet point?
Certainly. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and my mother's dear, dear childhood friend was the AO of the Chicago FBI field office. That's the person that's in charge of every single solitary FBI employee that is not a sworn FBI agent wearing a gun. So it's a very, very big job that she had. And she would talk all the time about the fine men of the FBI and the wonderful work they did and how great it feels to make a difference in this world. So I one day proclaimed as a young girl that when I grow up, I'm going to be an FBI agent. And they both laughed rather uproariously and said, honey, there are no female FBI agents. And I said, well, when I grow up, there will be, and I will be one.
Get out. So there were literally no, that was just unheard of to be a female FBI agent?
Yeah, there weren't any. People always ask you, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And the expectation is that you know what you're going to do. And of course, I wanted to be an FBI agent, but I knew it took like 2 years to get in. And who knows if you're going to make it. There's three major stage, and each one you lose like upwards of 50% of
the applicants. So it's a cut system as you go through?
Cut. Major. It's an evisceration practically. So I wasn't sure I was going to do it. And then senior year in college or senior year in high school, my mom came home and I was crying, which I don't do often because I'm a pretty optimistic person, which is a blessing. But she said, honey, what's wrong? And I said, Mom, you always told me to do what I love and I'll never work a day in my life. And she's like, well, why are you crying? I said, because I love everything I do. And she goes, that is nothing to cry about. You should be celebrating. And I had finally, when I got into the Bureau, the thing I realized most was, guys, it's just the coolest job on the planet. And when you get tired of one thing, we work over 700 different violations. So like you said earlier, Lisa, you know, you could be behavioral science, you could be working gangs or narcotics, you can work major financial institution fraud, you can work terrorism, you can go deep undercover. The continuum is so great.
Yeah.
It can just keep you just enraptured for over 25 years.
So I always thought that you had to be like law enforcement first and that feeds you into the FBI. Are you telling me that's not true?
No, that's not the case.
Okay.
We do have quite a few agents that are former law enforcement, former military. We have a ton of attorneys. We have a ton of accountants. We have people that can come in under the language program. It's been a long time since I applied, obviously, but anyone can go to FBI.gov and look under jobs, and it'll show you all the different ways you can work for the FBI. And there are a lot of what we call professional support positions that are just, all the professional support positions are crucial, but ones that might be just as appealing to you without having to carry a gun and go through all that rigmarole.
So you were saying that when you were a little girl, there were no female FBI agents, and here you're going through the process of becoming one. How many women were around you when you were going through? By then, was it more common?
The Bureau was 8% female when I came in. And just for clarification, I believe there may have been one female that was actually considered an agent, but I'm not sure she ever left the office. And that's one of the things that I think there may have been one, but there were none when I was that little.
Right.
So 8% female, and people would say, wow, wasn't that really hard being one of the... No, it just wasn't for me. I have... the FBI is a place where you're never going to be paid a dime less than a man for doing the same job. You know, that's been my norm.
Yeah, I heard you say that. Somebody at CrimeCon came up to you, a young woman, and was asking you kind of the same question I just did. And I remember hearing you say that nobody ever messed with you. Nobody ever harassed. Like, you never felt like your gender was in any way, any sort of handicap or
no.
Like you. But, you know, are you from a family of brothers? Is that right?
Yeah, I have two brothers, but it's my three sisters that toughen me up. I mean, anyone that has three older sisters knows exactly what I'm talking about. And my poor mother having six kids.
But I'm just wondering if your background, you come from a family of law enforcement, you know, public service.
Absolutely.
Tough.
Absolutely.
And like
iron workers.
Yeah,
I mean,
nobody's going to fuck with you. I mean, you are sitting here right now, are a presence. I mean, she's beautiful. You have a physical beauty, but also a physical presence. You command attention with your voice. And seriously, she could bench press me right now. I mean, she could like throw me out the window. She has a strong. I mean, you just are strong. And I mean that.
I have a strong chi, like what they talk about, that inner energy.
Sure.
But I grew up on the south side of Chicago and we had a lot of challenges there. And I grew up playing sports and I love being athletic. I love being outside. I love all that stuff. So I had to fend, being number five of six children, I had to fend for myself. And no one was going to give me anything. I had to, you know, get it.
Right.
Go out and fight for it.
So you go through the process of being in the FBI. What are the first steps in that process? I'm just curious, when you went in, you just, training?
They do all kinds of testing. They test everything from they give you one of those really comprehensive psych tests to determine if you're batshit crazy or not.
Well, I'm out, clearly.
And they do, they test you for firearms, a lot of physical fitness, physical proficiency. You have to be able to do push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's all that. And then the intensity seems to really crescendo, and then it sort of drops off once you reach that third point, and then you go to the academy. The vetting is so thorough that by the time you get to the academy, especially now, your chances of getting kicked out are relatively low because they vet so well, which is good because it costs a lot of money to put someone through the FBI Academy.
And how long is that training? Is that at Quantico?
No, you got me. I think it's like 5 months in Quantico, yeah.
Okay. And then I guess it's like when you go to college and you're looking at electives and trying to figure out like what what path you're going to go on?
You don't pick your path.
Oh, okay.
No, you don't pick your path. You're assigned your path.
Gotcha.
Everything you do in the Bureau, specifically back then, but it's still true today, is based on what we call the needs of the Bureau. So if the Bureau needs you to, work on some big case, you're going to get TDY'd, like temporary dutied, over to that investigation.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in the Academy, you don't even know where you're going to go. They have you fill out a list to say where you'd like to be assigned. And they have all the cities in the United States listed, and you list them from one on down, and you generally get the one in the middle or toward the bottom. Not always, just kidding. But there's a day in the Academy where you get your orders, and each new agent goes to the front of the class by themselves with an envelope. They open it up, and they have to read out loud where they're going to be assigned. And the people that get Alaska, of course, it engenders a big, oh, no, or wherever. And it's funny, you know. So
what was in your envelope?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
So I was happy because I came from a big family, big loving clan. And there's still, everyone's there in Chicago. And I just wanted to get away for a couple of years. I thought it would just be a couple of years. And here I am, Lisa, wow. I'm still here.
You're still here. Mm-hmm. We're so glad you're here. So, Maureen has worked on so many different kinds of cases. I guess you're most famous for your work with LA gangs. You want to talk
probably
about that?
Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to be assigned to the LA Sheriff's Department Elite Gang Task Force out in Compton, and that was a real challenge. That was a little more challenging because when I first went there, I know these guys. I know I know how local law enforcement officers are because I come from a big family of them. And when I walked in, you see it on TV sometimes. We don't always see it in real life, specifically out in Los Angeles, where we have such a great relationship with so many law enforcement agencies. But initially, they were a tough audience, and I knew it going in. So I just rolled up my sleeve and did whatever they wanted, and now we're like family. We go to mm-hmm. each other's weddings and baptisms, bar mitzvahs, whatever. But it took a little work. You got to be humble. You got to leave your ego at the door. You got to work your ass off, and you have to bring it. And when you say you're going to do something, you better do it or you're going to hear about it.
Right.
And I work very well in that environment, believe it or not.
So you're interfacing, with the regular cops. You're the FBI agent. Who has the senior,
Who has the lead?
Yeah.
Well, the case was the case was essentially prompted by the murder of Deputy Jerry Ortiz, and Jerry Ortiz, by all accounts, was just a true American hero. He was a kid that grew up and worked his life to help young kids everywhere. He had a boxing studio for the young, all the kids that were at risk. He did everything he could. He volunteered. He was a great dad. Wonderful husband, and really super handsome. Not that that has anything to do with anything, but he was
mm-hmm.
he was just one of those guys that had it all.
Mm-hmm.
And he got murdered trying to investigate Hispanic gangs that were shooting at black people just because they were black. And I'm not talking about gang-on-gang activity. I'm talking about innocent black families that were just trying to better themselves, and they were trying to kill them. So Jerry went after them like he did everything with a vengeance, and he went up to a door, and unbeknownst to him, the murdering coward was behind the door, and when the old lady answered the door, the murderer had his gun within the crack of the door and fired a round right into Jerry Ortiz's head and killed him. That was a heartbreaker. It broke my heart because, my dad died a duty death as a firefighter in Chicago. Oh, so did my uncle.
I'm so sorry.
And
so
it
sucks. You got it. You got it like deep in your gut.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to way too many law enforcement funerals, and it is a nightmare. And it's called blue racism. I went there and we started on they had started already doing the first wiretap before I came on board. Then I came on board. We ended up doing 33 back-to-back wiretaps, which is unprecedented. We worked night and day, weekends, we answered anything, and we embarked on a multi-pronged approach that would blow anyone's mind. The level of dedication in these men that I worked with was just mind-blowing. It took everything I had. I'm a worker, and I'm a person that rolls up my sleeve, no problem. It took everything I had to keep up with these guys. I mean, it was to say it was impressive is just an understatement.
Yeah, they were on fire. They were very inspired to do that.
We were on fire. And I mean, for 5 years, we were on fire. And it ended up being the largest gang takedown in U.S. history, the largest RICO indictment ever written, and both of those still stand to this day. And that was in, I think, 2007.
Back to the street gang.
Agents say they started tracking the gang about 4 years ago after a reputed member of the gang, Jose Luis Gerardo, killed 35-year-old L.A. County Sheriff Deputy Jerry Ortiz, who works out of the Lakewood Station.
So when you're wiretapping, what are you trying to learn? Is it just intelligence? Is it, like, what is the information that you're looking for?
Well, first of all, in order to get, everyone's like, I think someone's listening to my phone. And my standard reply is, trust me, you're not that interesting. In order for us to tap your phone, someone's got to write about a 75 to 120 page affidavit.
Sure.
We have to prove that that what we want to get from you, we can't get from any other avenue. We can't get it from surveillance. We can't get it from talking to other people. We can't get it from informants. There's all kinds of hurdles you have to go over. And it has to be signed off by a judge. And so you get a 30-day order, generally. So in this 30-day order, if you don't get what you thought might be there, it gets turned off and you can't do it again. But oftentimes you'll get another phone call, like a call will come in and it'll be what we call a really dirty call. And that dirty call from the other person may give you enough probable cause to go up on their phone. So see, that's how we did it.
Mm-hmm.
But we found that a lot of the women were... no shock to any of us, but the women were really facilitating a lot of these shot calls from the prisons. They go to visit their significant others, and they come back with some orders. So we decided we were going to go after the women too, and I said, I'll be the face for that, no problem. And we did. We were hell-bent on justice.
Oh, my God. This is just like The Wire, I think. This. I don't know, did you ever watch The Wire?
Yeah, The Wire was great.
Yeah, but
this was like The Wire.
Yeah, because it's like there's somebody in prison who still is in power and calling the shots through people
right in
their neighborhood. That's crazy. So did you arrest the women first, or did you somehow, you know, I'm just interested in the whole process of it. And are you gathering evidence on the drugs that they're moving?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we everyone that we hooked up or arrested, we tried to flip if we thought they had good information that would help us move forward. We arrested people on all kinds of drug charges. And what we're doing is we're putting a puzzle together. And the puzzle has to be comprehensive. It's got to be complete. The hallmark of any good law enforcement officer or any good investigation is to follow the facts and only follow the facts. I don't want anyone to think that we were on any kind of a witch hunt, because we weren't. We had the coward murderer in custody, which, by the way, we found him with, I think his pants were wet in the tub, hiding in another place nearby. Right. Big shocker. But we go where the facts lead us. So when we arrest people and we find stuff and we put it together and we examine it and we look at the evidence and we talk to other people and we go back to everything that we learned on the last takedown we did, or be it large or small, we worked and worked and worked until we got to our big takedown. We did two gargantuan takedowns, one of which included 1,500 law enforcement officers from all over the country. We had SWAT teams. We had to bring in SWAT teams from all over the place. We pretty much shut down Hawaiian Gardens and,
Leading up to that, you must be just the adrenaline pumping in you, or are you just a cool customer. You know, it just seems
the adrenaline. What we call it popping hot. The adrenaline is popping hot, and you can feel it. But that's usually on the day of a warrant or the morning of. Or, but the thing about adrenaline is when you come down from adrenaline, you about slip into a coma.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those times where you wake up and you're drooling and you don't know who you are or where you are. That's the aftermath of adrenaline.
Right. What FBI skills do you bring to that situation that are different from the law enforcement that's already on the ground and there?
Well, I brought a different set of resources since I was assigned to that case. I could bring behavioral science people, look at someone. I could have our evidence response team, which I was a part of. So the FBI's ERT is a fantastic, unbelievably skilled set of individuals that volunteer to go over and above their regular assigned duties to join the evidence response team, or ERT. We get training that is just world class, and we are specialists in every different discipline that you can think of under the realm of CSI. So I would have our ERT team work on one or two of our crime scenes that we came across. There were murder scenes that I would look at, or I could send back to headquarters to have them review. The Bureau could pay for one or two of the wiretaps. Each wiretap at that time, I think, was $30,000.
What?
For one? Yeah, that doesn't include manpower.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they're very labor-intensive. And they're not 24 hours a day unless that's part of the order.
Right.
But, you know, we would go from, I would base it on me personally. If I would surveil them first, and if I'm looking at you, Lisa, and you go to bed at 2 in the morning and you get up at 11 a.m., that's what I'm going to base my wiretap on. Mm-hmm. So that I'm not listening from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Okay. I'm listening when you're awake.
Right, right. I want you to tell me, having faced everything that you faced, and I know we're going to talk about a case that you worked on, but what scares you?
The lack of situational awareness scares the hell out of me, because in every single active shooter, every single mass murder, you name any large-scale event, significant event, and there were signposts all along the way that no one saw, no one reported. And I mean, just to really dummy it down, how many times do you pull up to an intersection and almost hit someone, even like a mother with a baby, and she's just looking at her phone, pushing the carriage right out into the street? It's just mind-blowing to me.
So connect that for me about when you're talking about mass shootings. What are the signposts that are actually actionable? I mean, I know that people have been talking about red flags and the many mass shootings we've had recently, but a lot of them, you know, you can't arrest somebody for being an asshole or being odd or being, you know, like what?
Right. Well, in the particular instance of the Las Vegas shooter, he more than doubled his cachet of weapons within 1 year. And those weapons were long guns, and he had a sniper scope, and he was buying bipods and all this other, and the bump stocks. I mean, someone should have reported that. I don't care. We're not asking the general public to do anything other than to report it. We'll connect the dots and we'll put these clusters together. So we're looking for clusters, essentially. So one of them would be the acquisition of weapons. One of them would be a change in your physical appearance, like you become more unkempt, et cetera. One would be disassociation from people and friends and sort of turning into yourself a little bit, or any other major change.
So any of these on their own, you know, is not going to get anybody arrested. So you're just saying that you would start to monitor this person or just keep them, like, so then what do you do with that information? You know?
Well, I think a better question right now would be, or a better answer would be, what do you do with the information when you see something? Because everyone says when you see something, say something, but say something to who and in what form? So the FBI and local law enforcement all have websites and everything where you can put in tips or leads. Even if you just Google tips or leads and the name of the department near you, you can submit tips or leads. There are fusion centers throughout the country that have tip or lead sections that will push that information out to whatever law enforcement agency is responsible for that particular event. For example, here in Los Angeles, we have the JRIC, the Joint Regional Intelligence Center in Norwalk, and they have fantastic outreach programs, one of which is called, the primary one is called InfraGuard. It's the FBI's public-private sector outreach program, of which I happen to be the national president.
Okay.
And InfraGuard, if you become a member, or even if you don't, you can submit a tip or lead online, and that information will get to wherever it should go.
Okay. And it's funny because it seems like after these kind of shootings happen, very quickly we know the name of the shooter and all these things about them. But again, what could law enforcement have done to deter that? Just how could having all of – I guess
– A lot of these things can't be thwarted. I mean, yeah. Unfortunately, the round has left the chamber, as we say in law enforcement, meaning it's – we're almost beyond that point. But the acquisition of all those weapons should have triggered a lot of bells and whistles and red flags.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't understand how that didn't. I know that the ATF has a database or a system wherein when any large number of handguns are purchased, that they get a notification, but they don't get the notification with long guns. I would be shocked if that doesn't change like immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be one thing. But other than that, I am not sure, unfortunately, what we can do.
When you're an abused woman or an abused person, even a child, you're on the defensive all the time. And when you're on the defensive, you're not able to make good, solid, offensive decisions. So that could definitely impact the overall scenario. However, I don't think that these markers, all these markers could have been missed. And I'm not saying that this could have been prevented, because I doubt that seriously. But the amount of planning,
right. Yeah.
The amount of planning that went into this attack is just insurmountable.
And I know that you were going to talk to me about a case.
You had asked me what case haunts me,
mm-hmm.
and one of the cases that haunts me is actually an LAPD case. In the 90s and 2000s, the FBI ERT team, we decided to start working with LAPD Homicide, specifically the Pacific Division, because I had one of the kids I grew up with in Chicago, and his dad was a cop, and his mom and my mom were good friends. And we went to grammar school together and everything. He was a homicide detective in Pacific Division. So I decided to, he was telling me one time that resources are so slim, SID, which is their CSI, you know, it's hard to get them out there to really spend time because they're having so many shootings and murders and everything. So I said, hey, we're always looking for training. And we spend a lot of our time trying to figure out training scenarios. Why don't we just join forces and our team will work with you? So we worked on several high profile and low profile homicides together. And one of them really, really broke my heart because it involved a young Russian girl who was the only child of her parents. And she was sent over to this country under the ruse that she was going to be an au pair. And that was not the case at all. They wanted her here for the sex trade.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go into these cases, Lisa, even if it's a bank robbery or money stolen or whatever, child abduction, whatever the case is, you just delve into the details and you go to a dark place that you never even thought possible. You know, people wonder why cops are so salty and everything. You see enough of the situations like the one I'm going to talk about and you'll understand exactly why. There's a category we call things you can't unsee.
Yep.
And when we start seeing all, you know, after your 25th session with things you can't unsee, you just, you know, people get all worked up about stuff and you're like, yeah, congratulations. Unfortunately, that's not even pinging my radar. So good luck, you know. But in this particular case, this young girl, her parents sent her over here with all the money that they had saved. They sent her to Los Angeles, where she was promptly picked up by a Russian man, pimp, piece of crap, oxygen thief, I think it was the bus station. She came downtown LA from LAX in a bus. Anyhow, they picked her up and fed her drugs against her will And within 48 hours, she was addicted to heroin. Then they kept her at a drug dealer's, or she was working for a guy downtown, a pimp that was doing this to all kinds of women. And the guy that this pimp was buying drugs from, who lived in Venice, Big Al, they called him, a Russian guy. Big Al went to provide him with some drugs. The pimp didn't want to give up money, so he gave them Alyssa. And Alyssa Sologubova, I believe that was her name, she was beautiful, and I still remember the photo. I can still see her face in my mind, and she had a mole on her neck, and the reason that's important is I'll tell you in a little bit. But she was held in an apartment in Venice, and it was a like an 8-unit place where you walked in the front center, and there were 4 on each side, and then there were actually more upstairs. And she stayed up there with a drug dealer, and this drug dealer slung dope to some major, major A-listers, and I mean like in the top 5 or 10. I'm not going to name the one person because I personally know that he's done everything in his power to come back around. And
when you say A-lister, you're just in general. You
Hollywood.
Mean Hollywood A-lister, okay.
Huge A-lister. He used to go there every day for drugs, and but he's turned his life completely around. But he hung out with this person. So we started working this case because Alyssa was found at the Hyperion Water Treatment Plant. She had been stuffed down a sewer. She was dismembered. And we didn't know initially if she was cut up and stuffed down the sewer or if she was pulled apart by the mechanics of the high flow of water and a bunch of ladders down there and everything. So it was, they were so happy to have us on the case because we were able to throw a ton of resources. We spent, we hit the warrant, we hit the house early in the morning with a warrant one day. And as we walked into the place, you can assess a building generally from the exterior. You know, we scan everything as when we look at things. We scan people, we scan cars, we scan situations. And when I pulled up to this place, it was O-Dark 30, as we say, and it looked like a really nice apartment building in Venice. I mean, it wasn't...
Oh, really? So it wasn't like, it didn't look like a slum?
It wasn't gross at all. Yeah. It was nice. It was really nice, actually. And I came up through the front door. It was clean. It didn't smell. Yada, yada, yada. They hit the door, actually, when the SWAT guys hit the door, I was right outside, and I got up on the radio and said, we have activity in the front window. They were up, and the light turned on. Anyhow, we get in there. It was the filthiest, most disgusting apartment I may have ever been in, which is shocking because I have been in shitholes that would blow your mind. They had a fish tank that stunk. It had dead fish in it. It was green. It was a swamp. It was, I mean, I don't know. The carpeting was sticky. It was sticking to the bottom of our boots. I mean, it was gross. And the man that lived there was a troll, this drug dealer guy. But anyhow, we went in and we spent about 8 hours with Luminol looking for the place where she was murdered. Because we didn't, as I said at that time, we didn't know whether or not she was cut up or if she was pulled apart. So we didn't come up with much. And as is the case in many of these investigations, you hook this person up and you're not sure if they're going to spend any time in jail at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the shame of being arrested may be the only thing they ever suffer, which is horrible. So we got him out in front and I'll never forget, he had a black T-shirt on. And he had no shoes or socks on. We had him hooked up, and he's standing there. And I can't even tell you how gross he was. Between his, I don't know which was more disgusting, his teeth or his toenails. And I told him that. I was like, dude, you are, because he was mouthing off to us and yelling. And I just said, buddy, with those toenails and those teeth, you shouldn't be talking to anyone.
Oh.
He did some time for the drug charges, but he was never charged with that murder. And I know I just spoke with a homicide detective on the way in here, and Mark said, you know, the last time he looked him up right before he retired, this guy was living out in Riverside, but we're convinced beyond anything that he did it. The coroner came back and said that she was strangled. He said that she was dismembered by the force of the water, not by any instrument.
Mm-hmm.
The scars or the marks were were caused by pulling, mm-hmm. not by a sharp instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But the coroner did say that she was strangled. He was still able to see that. And the reason I talked about the mark on her neck was because she had that mole on her neck, and there was a photo that we got. I don't know if it was from missing persons or her family, but her head was tilted to the side, almost like she was modeling, and she had this, you could see the mole on her neck. And so when the coroner turned her head to show the mole and took a photo of it, unbeknownst to him, it was just this eerie, eerie depiction of what had happened to her from this beautiful young girl that came to this country with such big dreams,
yeah.
with her head tilted in just this way, and then to have the picture of her head turned in the exact same way,
God.
To scientifically show the mole in the right. same position. But the differentiation was just...
The juxtaposition is
the juxtaposition just broke your heart. And then her parents had to fly here from Russia, and the LAPD has a bunch of linguists on hand to help with different situations. And they had these two ladies that were Russian linguists, and they picked the parents up, and they were translating for them the whole time. The parents ended up staying with these Russian translators the whole time, and they became friends, and these wonderful translators became a source of great comfort to these people who had to come here to bury their daughter.
Had there been a search going on for her as a missing person, or did she come to your attention because her body was found, or how did it all kind of start?
That her body was found at the Hyperion, and then the parents, then we found out that the parents had been trying to get in touch with her and weren't able to. So, the first body found at a water treatment plant.
And I have to say, this is not the first story I've heard like that of you know, women coming here from other countries and being traded for just all kinds of things. And I think...
Disgusting.
Yeah. I know our on Criminal Minds, you know, people do a lot of research into crime, obviously. And where our studio is, I think one of the writers told me, is like the hotbed for, what do you call it, human trafficking. And it's this very, you would never, like you say about the apartment in Venice, like you would never dream that this neighborhood with very nice houses and very nice schools is like a hub of that kind of activity. I mean, the things that go on that we don't see are astonishing.
Well, Lisa, if you think of before the internet and before Google, I remember being a brand new agent and we had some bad guy, I forget what case it was, but he had like some sexual fetishes, which I, at that time, I didn't even know what a sexual fetish was. And you had to go to bookstores or old video stores back in those days and rent out these creepy, disgusting videos. So this guy was in one of these video stores one time, and I had to go in and make like I was looking for something. And another hallmark in this line of work is you have to be able to be completely gobsmacked and not show it on your face. I was walking through those aisles. I was like, granny porn?
Oh.
What? Foot porn?
Oh, my God.
Pregnant women porn? All this stuff. I was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
I mean, it's disgusting. So that was, you had to have a different level of commitment to do that. But with the internet, with encrypted apps, you can do anything. You can get your freak on at home. And that has exploded the industry. People think that human trafficking, those numbers must be going down. They have absolutely exploded in the last 20 years. It's like, you know, before you may have certain inklings towards one thing or another, but you could never act on it. Now it's so easy. And what I tell people is don't ever open the portal. Resist the urge to open these portals. Because it seems to me that once you get turned on by something like this, it's a rabbit hole
mm-hmm.
that you don't want to go down.
Yeah. Wow. We've covered a lot of ground, but I want to ask you about what you're doing now. You have your own company?
Yep. I have my own company, Maureen O'Connell and Associates, and I do consulting work and security work, high-level stuff. We search for, we do all kinds of stuff, but one of the things we do is we search for bugs, and it's just interesting that how cheap bugs are, so you can buy them anywhere, and people place them in each other's homes, and you think it's for, like, blackmail, and a lot of times it's people are just voyeurs and
really
once again getting their freak on.
So it's just like normal people. I mean, I would think that maybe like big businesses are trying to spy on each other for corporate secrets.
Yes, there's a ton of that. Yes.
Yeah.
And so private jets, like if you use a jet sharing company or something, I don't know that I would talk too much business on there unless you're sure that they get searched for bugs, because that's pretty interesting. Boardrooms do it. Most big businesses with a lot of intellectual property, they do it on a regular basis. Most companies, they have a pretty good understanding of what the risk is. They've got great security directors. A lot of these security directors, almost 100%, are all former law enforcement, a lot of them FBI. So they understand the risks involved, and we put on a lot of training. And I'm working. I'm a contractor. I'm going to be going to Puerto Rico to help with the communications for the people that are reestablishing the grid.
Wow.
So the conditions are supposed to be pretty austere. So this will be like being back in the bureau on ERT.
Right,
crazy crime scene.
Well, I say this to Jim and Laura all the time, but I'm always so honored to sit down with
you.
I mean, it's true. You're a hero. I mean, you go where we don't go, where we can't go, and you know things, and you see things that we shouldn't see.
Right.
And I'm amazed by you in so many ways.
So sweet.
Aw, I'm not. But anyway, anything you want to, you know, I always like to ask people if there's anything you want to recommend, any book you've read, any TV show you've read, any charity you want to promote on our show. You know, Jim and Laura and I are watching Mindhunter right now.
Have
you been watching it?
Yes.
Yeah, so we're taking it all apart, you know, kind of episode by episode. And I've got lots of things to say about the casting and all that stuff. But what do you love to watch? Are you like a Homeland kind of girl? Or
nope, I've never seen Homeland. Mm-hmm. I'm going to eventually watch it, I think, but...
Are you a Real Housewives kind of girl?
Absolutely not. I like watching true crime stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I love watching British television.
Me too.
I love Acorn. Yes. I love everything British.
I can't decide whether to get Acorn or there's another BritBox. They both have like pros and cons, and my listeners are trying to like let me know like what's better.
I just got Acorn, and it's not as easy to navigate as Netflix.
I have to say.
I don't know. But I love Swedish mysteries.
Yeah.
I love all the because there's two things I like. I like the true crime stuff where it's a little rugged, but I can also learn something. So when it's in a different country, I like looking at the topography and the characters. I like listening to different languages, and it just kind of removes me from wherever I am. But I also really love watching things that transport me. So I love old classic films because then it's easy breezy and it's light and airy and it's I can just look at it from an artistic standpoint. And that's about it. As far as a charity, it's not really a charity, but the program I told you guys about, InfraGard, InfraGard.org. InfraGard.org is the FBI's public-private sector outreach program, but we put on training for active shooter scenarios and all this kind of stuff all the time. But we need money to do it because, as you can imagine, the need is so high. So if you go to InfraGardLosAngeles.org, you can donate there. It's a 501c3. You're not actually giving money to the FBI. It's a separate 501c3 that a lot of us that are former FBI agents are a part of because we really believe in the mission. And that's
great. I'll post that on our Facebook page and our listeners. And I think just you tracking your path into the FBI will be very inspirational to lots of our listeners because they're very active, they're very engaged, and a lot of them are heroes too. So, and they would love to take your advice.
All you young women out there, I encourage you strongly to try to become an FBI agent. It'll take a while to get in there, but I'll tell you, if you're lucky enough to be chosen, you will embark on the ride of a lifetime. Just an unparalleled journey. It's amazing. The Bureau right now is less than 20% female. We're looking for qualified candidates, and it is just unbelievable.
Well, if I had to do it over again, I think I might have.
Great. You'd be great at it.
Oh, God. Maureen, thank you for coming in and jumping in while Laura and Jim are away. I hope I did a good job.
You
I'm sure
did.
If I didn't, our listeners will let me know. But and I'd love to have you back on anytime.
Anytime. And I love Jim Clemente. He's my buddy.
Who doesn't love Jim Clemente?
I know.
My J. Clem. And Lady Laura. Okay, we're going to sign off for now from Real Crime Profile.
Bye.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clemente. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org, and there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.